Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross. Good to have you here on the program today. My guest today, as most of you know, I'm very partial to real estate. So my guest today is Sage Finder. He's known as the property pastor. I'm sure he's going to share a little bit why he calls himself that. But he currently has a portfolio of 9 deals, 26 stores. And we'll talk about what that means. And he invests in mostly small multifamily units. He's also a pastor, senior pastor at Branches of Divine Community Church. He's been married for 16 years, has 3 children, and he also works as an engineering manager at a manufacturing company. So welcome, Marseille, to Your Personal Finance. I hope you're doing well today. How are you?
I'm doing great, Charles. I appreciate you having me on the show today. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, man, it's great. The honor is all mine. I'm always like to hear from brothers and sisters out there, you know, making things happen, man. You've got a lot going on. You've got a full-time job. You're a pastor. You've got 3 kids. I got 4 girls, mostly all grown. So that's enough to keep you busy. So let's dive right in and explain, you know, why you got into real estate. How did you get into real estate? What prompted you to say, you know what? You know, being a pastor and having a full-time job is not enough. I want to do something. So tell me how that came about.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, I try to answer this question kind of concisely, but, you know, long story short, I got into real estate really through my father, he's a general contractor in the area and has been, you know, had his own business for, you know, over 30 years. And just being around him growing up from the time I was, you know, 7, 8 years old, you know, climbing up on rooftops and cleaning up job sites, you know, he started to pick up properties as he was working on them. So he kind of just naturally started showing me some of that stuff. But he did it kind of on a small scale. You know, fast forward, you know, 25, 30 years later, as I got older, you know, working a normal corporate job, being a church planter, you know, kind of starting a church from scratch, it didn't take long to figure out, you know, that it was going to take me a very long time working in corporate America to get to a place where I could control my own time. So I really got into just the vision kind of just became full circle to take and start acquiring properties. And so I kind of had the construction background with my dad, and, you know, had an introduction and just kind of went from there and said, you know what, I'm going to start buying properties, set my goals, you know, acquire at a decent clip, and then just work my way to get out of the rat race towards financial freedom. So that's kind of just for me how I got started into it about 3 years ago.
Oh, wow. So in 3 years, if the information I'm looking at is correct, that you've done 9 deals in 3 years and 26 stores. Explain, you know, for our audience, what does that mean, 9 deals? I'm doing the math. I'm assuming when you say multifamily, you're talking about duplexes and things like that, not apartment
exactly,
building.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
Go ahead. My plan is to start to scale up to, you know, apartment buildings. But I've started out primarily just with smaller multifamilies, like you said, duplexes, triplexes, and quads. And just purchasing those, which, you know, I'm not sure if folks on the line know that, but you can, there's commercial lending, and then there's, you know, your traditional lending. So anything that is, you know, 4 units or below, it can qualify for a traditional loan. But then when you shift up 5 and above, it's more of a commercial setup.
Okay. So you're mostly doing You're saying you're getting residential loans versus commercial loans. So, or since your units are under four, you're under four units, your property is under four units. Was that strategic in how you decided to do that? Is because of the lending criteria is a little different for residential versus commercial?
Well, a little bit. It's just easier, you know, when I was getting started, didn't really know all the ropes of commercial lending, which is not, honestly, it's not that much different. In a residential space, you know, it's really more about your own finances, but then we get in the commercial space, it starts to shift towards more of the property itself. And then as you get in the commercial space, the interest rates are not quite as good. So what a lot of first-time investors are, when you start now, you start out small scale, and then you just begin to kind of ramp up as time goes. Because some of the, you know, lending restrictions will only allow you to get up to, you know, anywhere from 4 to 10 what I consider residential loans in your name anyway. And after that, you got to go to the commercial side no matter what, or to the private side.
Well, in truth and sharing, I'm a real estate investor myself, and I specialize in what we call the sub 50 market. In other words, properties below below 50,000 in value, single family homes, and and as you just shared, but you shared a good nugget, which was you can only require, I think the Fannie Mae guidelines was four properties in your name or something like that.
Yeah, it just depends. Between 4 and 10 is usually the rule I use.
So you could do 4 to 10 properties in your name. And if you're married, I'm assuming that you could have 4 to 10 in your name and 4 to 10 in your wife's name. Is that your understanding?
Exactly. As long as she's on board with it.
Well, that's a good question. Is your wife on board with this? Is she kind of, because, you know, women tend to be a little bit more conservative. So, she has to be on board. You've got 26 doors, so she's got.
Yeah, she is. She's not quite as active in it as I am, but she's definitely part of my support system. And she's like, yeah, no, I trust you know what you're doing, so go for it. And started to take some of her individual retirement account money to help her to invest in real estate as well.
Exactly.
She's rolled over from previous employers.
And, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, you do need a support system, you know, folks around you that think the same way, that are progressive and thinking, that you can talk real estate about, you know, because a lot of times I have found that the real estate community is very open to sharing information.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, because they see there's so much real estate out there, I'm not worried about competing with you because there's so many deals out there. Do you find that in the real estate community there? You're in Hampton, Virginia, is that correct?
I'm in Hampton, Virginia, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, what I found in my journey so far is that, folks are fairly willing to share information. And like you said, I mean, everybody needs somewhere to live. So there's not really a short supply of houses. And what I found is that if you're willing to put in the work, ask the questions, and then add value to somebody, then they are more than happy to, you know, share information. I think one of the things that becomes a bit of a struggle, and I deal with this a lot, is when people want to learn real estate, but they're like, just teach me everything. And it's like, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I don't have a HDMI plug or a USB that I can just download all this information. You got to put in some work. You got to do some reading. You know, you got to go and look at deals and analyze deals. So I think if you're willing to do those things and then add value, then people are definitely willing to kind of help you out.
Yeah, I see that to be the case. So walk me through, if you can, if you remember, your first deal, you know, because I understand that you shared, I've heard you talk on one of your YouTube channels how, you know, you read a lot for 6 months and then you finally pulled the trigger. So walk us through when you said, you know, and why did you choose, so you chose real estate, which is very interesting because of your dad. So you said your dad did it on a small scale. Oh, when you say small scale, he doesn't have many properties. He just has maybe a handful or something.
I mean, basically, yeah. For him, it was, hey, if he came across a really good deal, he could buy for, you know, you mentioned being in the sub 50 market. He's either sub 50 or maybe even sub 20 type of market. So, not a ton of deals like that. So whenever he came across them, it was kind of a side hustle for him. Like, let me pick up one here or there. But for me, it was a much more aggressive approach to say, okay, my goal is to pick up 2 to 3 properties in my first few years. And then, you know, I kind of just phased it and said, okay, as I go into years 4 through 8 or whatever, I want to double that number.
Okay. All right.
But you'd ask about my first deal.
Yeah, your first deal. How did that come about? You read some books. Okay, studied. Did you go to any workshops or anything like that? Because seminars. Because I know that's a big thing now. Did you go to any of those?
Not a lot of seminars per se. I was really active up front on Bigger Pockets. Their community, I think, is a great entry point, you know, just to kind of get what I consider a good foundation on things. But then I became active in my local Real Estate Investor Association. So in pretty much any city you're in is going to have one. You know, it's just going to be a group of like-minded people who meet up on maybe a monthly basis or weekly or whatever. And they just network, right? For me, it was really about that. Okay. And I kind of actually found my first deal through that local group. So I bought my first property through a wholesaler, which was a fourplex. And for me, it was, you know, just running numbers. Like you mentioned, I was really focused on my education first, learning as much as I could, reading as much as I could, going to as many meetings as I could and talking to folks. And the deal came along, you know, the wholesaler sent it out, and I ran my numbers. I looked at what it had in it and said, you know, this could be a good start. And I really wanted to go with a multifamily because of my first deal. If I could cash flow out of a multifamily and I had a vacancy early, then I would still be hedged against, you know, getting 3/4 of the rent is way better than getting 0% of the rent. So the multifamily space was a really good starting point for me. And like I said, I ran my numbers. I actually kind of did a miniature BRRRR on it, kind of a hybrid BRRRR deal, where I did some renovation on one of the units and did, you know, some exterior work. And I was able to raise my rents over the course of a year or two. And believe it or not, out of my whole portfolio, that property is still my best performing property.
Wow. So what price range are you looking for? A fourplex, what price range in Hampton would be acceptable for a fourplex?
So it kind of depends on the rents, right? I mean, if you're looking at, you know, for me, it's really about what my cash flow goal is and my cash on cash return. So for me, to give you an example, that first property I purchased, I only spent $65,000 on it. And at the time, it was bringing in about, I think, like $1,750. Well, over forced appreciation and putting a little bit of money into it, it reappraised for $120, and I'm pulling in about a little over $2,300 in rents now. So almost $600 of increase in rents, double the appreciation amount. And but again, that's a home run, right? I don't come across that every day. Another example, I just purchased another fourplex. I spent $150 for that, right? So I say that's I would think anywhere from the 150 to 200 range is probably normal for my market.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
Depending on what I can get in rents and appraisals and things like that, that's kind of dictates what I'm actually willing to pay for. So to me, it's really all about cash on cash return.
Because I'm looking at that first deal is almost like a 20% a 20% cap rate on the initial purchase, awesome. Which is normally would see. I'm like your dad, okay? I'm in the sub-50 market. Mm-hmm. One of my properties cost me $28,000, and I'm getting $500 a month. You know, so but I'm looking at 40 to 50 thousand, and that's only because in the area that I'm in, and it's in Macon, Georgia. And it's a really unique area where you have a ton of properties in that range. I'll say between the $35,000 and $50,000 range, and they're pulling in $600-$700 a month rent. And that's because in Atlanta, Atlanta is swamped with real estate investors. Okay, so if I was going out, I recently bought a new house, and I'm renting out, the old house. That's more the kind of deal that you're talking about. You know what I'm saying? It's a single family, situation. But like I said, there's so many ways to skin the cat. So how did you feel to that deal? Because a lot of people, because one of the things that my wife and I did the same thing. We hooked up with a real estate group in Atlanta that they meet every week. And these are people that are doing deals. But what I found was when I start talking to people, they were still studying after a year or so. And I'm like, after a certain point, you kind of know you have to figure out your market, what you want to do, and then pull the trigger. You got to go and do it. I'm one of those kind of people that, you sound like the same kind, is that I learn by doing. I mean, you have to process. The biggest challenge I had, and I want to ask, I want you to share what the biggest challenge you had with not necessarily this property, but you know, just overall, mm-hmm. is the financing. Right. And so I had to find mm-hmm. a lender that will lend right. below. You know, because normally they won't lend anything below 75. Sometimes maybe
75. Yeah, that's what we run into.
Yeah, 75. So yeah. I had to find a lender, and I found one. And this lender mm-hmm. will lend 15% on just about any amount, $20,000. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. So that was the biggest thing I had to overcome. Once I got that overcome, mm-hmm. then it was rocking and rolling. And I've actually got my mm-hmm. nephew involved to buy deals. So what was the biggest thing that you had to overcome in order to pull your trigger on your first deal? What did you have to overcome? What was the thing that was holding, or was anything holding you back?
Well, I guess for me it was about probably analysis paralysis. And like you mentioned, you know, in your RIA group, folks that have been studying for a year and whatnot, and I pretty much came to the point of like, okay, my numbers are there, opportunity is there, I've got the funding in place to do what I need to do. Is another one going to come around, right? So I think at the end of the day, you almost have to kind of set some deadlines for yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
But even in that's got to be balanced, because if you say, okay, I'm going to buy a deal by December 31st, but you buy a terrible deal, then, you know, you haven't really helped yourself, right? You're going to learn a ton, but at the same time, you haven't really helped your goals. You've helped your skill set. So for me, it was just that whole thing of, okay, everything is aligned. Let's make this happen. So once I finally did it, you know, and it's interesting, you know, that was the first barrier. But then while I got into the property, it was a much older property. So a lot of the multifamily space in my area are older homes. You know, you've got houses built way before the 50s, you know, some of them even in the 20s. So you've got all sorts of, you know, plumbing challenges. You got all sorts of structural challenges. You know, on the positive side, the house has been sitting, you know, it's been standing for 100 years. Somebody did something kind of right. So those are some of the challenges, because, I think that first fourplex I bought, I had major plumbing, you know, drainage problems for the first year until we finally figured out what was going on. And there were times when I was like, man, did I make the right call? Should I sell this place? Is it worth my energy and my time? Well, you know what? I endured those things. And, you know, even though it cost me about $1,000, it was worth it. You know, and like I said, today that property is my top performer.
Wow.
So
yeah.
I think it's, you know, two things, right? It's the getting started and then just overcoming the adversity that you face, because you're inevitably going to face adversity, but that's just part of the process.
Oh, yeah. And let alone just the whole process of if you get financing. Did you finance the property or you bought it out cash?
So what I did with this property, and you know, as I mentioned, my dad's a contractor. So he did something that really set me up well in life, is that he deeded me a piece of land in front of his house. So he actually built his own house. He's fortunate enough to have the skill set to be able to do it. And then he said, hey, if you want to come home, we can do yours too. So we built my house, which basically gave me a ton of equity in my home. So I basically went and put in a HELOC on my house and used that to start, is my seed money to start my business. So I bought that first property cash, rehabbed it, and then just refinanced it out and took that money and reused it again.
Got it. Okay. And there's always different ways to skin a cat, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, the biggest key is that people, you know, have to understand that it's going to cost some money. Now, can you find deals mm-hmm. that you might be able to get in with no money down? Yeah, you might get some owner financing and stuff like that. But generally, mm-hmm. you know, those deals, you know, you have to be real patient to find those deals.
Yeah.
And they do exist, but you got to be more patient. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, you're going to have to, you know, come out of the pocket with some cash. Like, for example, with the properties I look at $30,000 and 15% mm-hmm. down, I've got to come out of my pocket with, you know, $4,500, you know.
Right.
So that's
right.
a little easier. That's the other thing about sub-50 market. Because of the down payment requirement, I don't have to come out of my pocket with a lot, you know,
right.
with a lot of money.
Your barrier to entry is not quite so bad. Yeah,
it's not so, exactly. You know, people say, okay, I can come up with $4,500, you know, and buy a $30,000 property, you know, 15% down,
mm-hmm.
you know, 4 or 5%
right.
interest. Hey, you know, you just got to figure out, make sure you get it rented. So you're doing mostly buy and hold. Now, why did you choose buy and hold?
So for me, I mean, I prefer buy and hold because it's a wealth generator.
Okay.
You know, I looked at other models like flipping houses, but really, you know, doing a house flip, and nothing against doing a house flip because you make great money. But to me, the drawback to doing a house flip was really in the area of the moment that I stopped flipping houses, I stopped making money.
Right.
When I buy and hold, you know, if I'm asleep on a Friday, if I'm asleep on a Saturday, the first of the month, that rent check still comes.
Right.
You know, so
right.
For me, it was really about creating that passive wealth. But then in addition, the tax benefits, you know, a lot of people don't always recognize that you've got many ways to benefit from a buy and hold, right? You've got your cash flow, you've got your debt pay down, right? Your tenants are paying your note down for you. You've got your appreciation, and then on top of all of it, you get tax savings. So for me, it was just a comprehensive wealth generator that outperformed what I was getting in the stock market. It outperformed what I could do, you know, in terms of generating funds through flipping houses. And then if I was going to flip a house, I also had to be very concerned about the market, right? Because as the market changes, you know, I could be, you know, upside down on the house. And if I didn't buy it correctly, then I'd be, you know, and I had to turn it into a rental, I would not make any money. So being on the other side of it, you know, if I'm just getting into the rental side, it's a slower process, but to me, it's a more stable process.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I've looked at flip, fix and flip, and, you know, and maybe later I'll share my strategies of what I'm looking at, is that also you mentioned tax savings. If you do a fix and flip, that's short-term gain. That's taxed just like ordinary
mm-hmm.
income.
You get, so, yep, ordinary income.
You make,
get beat
make
up.
$50,
yeah, you get beat up
exactly.
Pretty bad on tax.
Exactly, you know,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, and see, if in my case, and it sounds like in your case too, I don't want a job. You know what I mean? Whole
right.
flipping
right.
is a job. You've got
to yep.
monitor the contract. You have to have good contractors.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know a little
right.
bit about contracting and building, you know, so you don't get taken.
Right.
Now,
right.
granted, I've seen people, as a matter of fact, you know, I'm an educator, you know, so
mm-hmm.
around the school that I live in is going through some gentrification. And so I've driven
mm-hmm.
down the street where someone bought a house for 40 or 50, flipped that
mm-hmm.
joker and sold it for 250, okay? But they
right,
may have put
right.
100,000 into it, okay? So,
mm-hmm,
you know,
right.
and you have to really, you know, you're taking a bigger risk. And I think with a buy and hold
yeah.
strategy, you know, you're going to get your money, you know, every month. Now, have you done any Section 8 type of rentals?
So that's something is a good question, because a lot of folks are really steering towards Section 8 nowadays with the, you know, the pandemic and the different concerns that people have.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple of properties that I have targeted to convert over, but I haven't actually converted any of them yet because I haven't had any major tenant issues. But I'm actually in the process of certifying my properties through the inspection process so that I can utilize Section 8 in the future.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, mine's a Section 8, and one of the good things about it, you get your money at the, you know, every month, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know,
yeah,
even
I
if
mean,
it, you know,
I know
with Section
that.
8, it, you know, you get either 100% will be Section 8, or the difference
mm-hmm.
between what a voucher pays and what your rent
right.
is could be the difference. So especially
yeah.
in this pandemic, and I'm going back out into the
yeah.
market in 2021 to pick up about
mm-hmm.
3 to 4 properties, and I'm focusing nothing but my criteria is Section 8, tenant occupied.
Right.
You know, that's
wow.
just me.
How do you fare it with, so if you're getting a Section 8, you're getting an existing Section 8 tenant, though, right? Not necessarily
right,
just
right,
a tenant
right.
who's not on Section 8. Yeah, yeah,
right.
I got you.
Yeah, exactly.
I know sometimes some folks don't like to get an inherited tenant, but if you're dealing with a Section 8 setup, it's a little bit different because you already know they've got that established track record.
Yeah, and it also gives you some assurance that if there's anything wrong with the property, the tenant's going to
mm-hmm.
tell you, okay?
Right.
You're going to say, hey, the water's
yeah.
leaking, the electricity's screwed up, you know, whatever, you know.
Right.
So it gives
yep.
you some assurance that if someone's been living in there for a few years, that you and
mm-hmm.
in the market that I'm going into, you know, folks can only afford $600 to $800 a month rent. Now, there's other parts
right.
of town that is $1,300, but now you're talking about $100,000. But if I'm charging
exactly.
$1,300,
yeah,
I could get 2 or 3 properties for that, you know. So that's
right,
the rationale.
Right.
But that's what, you know, with
yeah.
the, with the, I've heard, I'm sure you've heard in Hampton, all around the country, there's a big tsunami happening with evictions coming up. in next year. And cash is going to be king, because a lot of mortgages, a lot of landlords are going to be wanting to get out of the market because they can't pay, because the folks hadn't paid their rent in 6 months and they want to get out, you know. So that's going to be a big, big opportunity for some people. So, so wholesaling, tell us about wholesaling and, you know, why that's something, you know, that someone should consider, and what other, under what circumstances should they consider it?
Yeah, so wholesaling, and again, I'm not a wholesaler, but I utilize wholesalers. I network with a lot of them. And I think, honestly, wholesaling is a really good way to get into the real estate market. I think the thing you just got to be careful of, if you become a wholesaler, is not to have an end game, right? Because the wholesaling is another income generator. It's not a wealth generator, right? You can only make money when you convert deals. Right, and that pipeline's got to stay full, because a wholesaler is going to be just as busy, if not more, than a person flipping houses. So I think if you don't have that you know, 20% down to, you know, buy your first property, but you want to get into real estate, I think wholesaling is a really good way, because you can leverage your wholesale skills to not only generate cash, but you can actually, once you understand and learn creative financing, you can convert some of those leads to things that you keep yourself through some low money down, zero money down type of deals. You know, for example, if you learn lease options or sub two deals, a lot of wholesalers that are starting to figure out, hey, you know, instead of me signing my contract, if I can negotiate with this seller to either do a subject to deal or to do a lease option or lease purchase, man, I can get to this property, you know, for next to nothing. So I think wholesaling does provide some really good entry points into real estate. And then I think it touches some of the preliminary phases. Really, to me, a wholesaler touches the beginning of the process and then kind of the end of a process, right? They're up front identifying, let me line up the deal, but then they're also at the closing table learning, you know, all the ins and outs of the closing process. They
so
just don't deal with quite as much of the rehab.
You mentioned creative financing and two aspects of it, lease option or lease purchase. Explain for audience what does that mean in creative finance? How is that creative? Share that insight.
All right. A lease, we'll start with a lease purchase, right? So first of all, a lease option is basically what we call a unilateral agreement. So what that means is, if I go into a property, I'm going to take control of that property without ownership of that property. So if I'm doing a lease option, like a lease option sale, basically what I'm doing is becoming a subtenant to a seller. So let's say, for example, I have a seller who, for all intents and purposes, they've had, like you talked about, the whole eviction problem. Right, where they've run through bad tenants, and they're like, man, I'm just tired of dealing with tenants, but I still have a mortgage to pay. And at this point, right, I can go to that seller and say, all right, I'm not ready to buy this property, but you know what? Let me line up a back-end buyer, somebody who's either in the military, which is heavy in my area, or somebody who makes good income but maybe doesn't have the greatest credit. So I'm now the person in the middle, right? So the nice part about a lease option, we call it a sandwich lease, is that it provides three paydays. So the first payday, right, when I find a tenant buyer, that tenant buyer is going to come and give me, you know, 5% down. So say, for example, I've got a $100,000 house, right off the bat, I'm getting 5% of that as a down payment, non-refundable option fee. But then if my seller, the person that I'm dealing with, let's say, for example, their mortgage is $500. Right, I'm now going to charge my tenant buyer a mortgage of maybe $800, right? So now I've made my $5,000 up front, and on top of it, I'm going to get another $300 in cash flow every month. But then the nice part on the back end of it is, if I go in and I say, okay, now we're ready to close this out, so my tenant buyer has had enough time to clean their credit up to qualify for a loan, and now they're buying the house outright, if there's any equity in the house, right, I get to keep the spread of that as well. So, you know, in that example, I've gotten $5 up front as a non-refundable option fee. I've got $300 per month, and then whatever equity spread on the back end, I get that as well.
Okay.
So that's really cool.
So whatever you negotiated the price for, to buy the house for, so a $100,000 house, you may have the house may be worth $150 over them, just as an example.
Right.
So you get to keep that difference.
Yep.
Got it. Okay. That's
exactly.
That's a sweet.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that's another thing that is really cool to add to the portfolio, because this is another tool. And I think what happens, you're talking about the example of wholesalers or the folks that are, you know, at the end of the day, if you're a wholesaler and all you know how to do is line up, flippers or people who do bird deals, you're going to turn away a lot of leads. But there are other ways where you can convert that lead. And I think it's really about figuring out what that person's problem is. You can figure out what their problem is and solve their problem, you can benefit from it at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so
wholesalers, and the key thing is with a wholesaler is make sure they have control of the property. That's the one thing. Because I've run into cases where they use me as, you know, leverage to get the deal. I've got this guy that wants to buy your house, give me a contract so I can, you know, do the deal, so to speak, you know.
Right.
Versus let me get the house under contract first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then come to
yep.
me, because then, you know, because you don't have any power as a wholesaler unless you have the house under contract.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you
know, it's got to be under contract. Yep.
Yeah, it's got to be under contract.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that has been interesting, you know, from that perspective. So let's go into the five hurdles that trip up new real estate investors, because I know there's a lot of people thinking about it and, you know, thinking about getting into real estate. You know, I was a stock guy early on in my career, but, you know, everybody talks about, oh, you know, Tesla and Amazon. Well, you have to have the foresight to get in there early, you know, and buy that stock. But if you don't do that, you have to hold on. And most people just, every stock you buy is not going to be a home run. Matter of fact, you probably lose a lot on most of the stocks you buy. You'll make money on maybe a handful, you know, if that much, you know. So you really know what you're doing. And you got to follow that stuff every day, and that's like a job, and I don't want another job.
Yep, it's too much work for me.
It doesn't mean not that you shouldn't have a stock portfolio, but if you're looking at a stock portfolio to provide the passive income we're talking about, that's not going to be the case. You see what I'm
saying?
That's
not going to be it, yeah.
Yeah.
And honestly, in my research, I found that, you know, I think it's some statistic like 95 or 98% of, you know, stock pickers can't outpick the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones.
No.
So it's like,
can't.
Well, shoot. And when I found that out, I just started buying index funds.
Yeah. And that's the truth.
Almost no point.
That's the truth. If you're going to be an investor in real estate, do mutual funds. I'm not talking about real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Investor in stocks, mutual funds, and index funds. Because most of the money managers can't beat the index fund, S&P 500, you know, Vanguard Index, whatever the case may be. You know, but believe me, I'm not, you know, disparaging stock investing. But for what we're talking about, you and I and the real estate investors that come on this show and talk about this stuff, we're looking up to set up passive income. So we could eventually live off that income if we had to. See, you can't do that with stock investing, okay? All right, so the five hurdles that trip up new investors. The first one you had on his lack of clarity. Explain why that trips up investors.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, first thing, you know, when you don't have clarity, I think it's a quote that says, when you don't know what you're aiming at, you'll hit it. When you're not aiming at anything, you'll hit it every time. I think you got to have that clarity of, you know, what is my financial independence number? You got to have that clarity of what is my investment vehicle, right? Am I going to, like we talked about already, am I going to do fix and flips? Am I going to do buy and holds? Am I going to do a little bit of everything? Am I going to wholesale, right? So I think you got to kind of start at the end and work your way backwards. Because without that clarity, you're going to find yourself all over the place. And when you run into roadblocks, you're easily discouraged. But I think we have that clarity of, hey, I'm working my way to this number, and I want to get to that number in 5 years. Well, guess what? I've run into a difficult deal, or I know I've run into something that I don't know how to do, that I need to close this deal. You just push through that because you're trying to get to that clear end, right? You're like, hey, at the end of the day, I'm a buy and hold investor. This property is going to make this amount of money. You know, even if it's got a roadblock along the way, so be it, right? And the long game is going to be successful. So I think the first step is to clarify your goals, right? And also clarify what you're good at, you know? And I think a lot of times folks don't really know what they're good at and what they're not good at. And I think when you realize what you are not good at, you got a couple of choices, right? You can either find somebody who is good at it and leverage them, Or you can get good at yourself and have a growth mindset and kind of say, okay, I'm not good at it today, but with enough work and energy and effort, I will be good at it.
Got it.
That's really, you know, for me, that's where the whole clarity piece comes in.
So the clarity is really clarifying your goals. You know, what is the end in mind? In other words, what are you leading up to? And then work your way back to the forward. Okay, you know, for example, if I want $100,000 a year in passive income, what is it going to take? Mm-hmm. When we're talking about real estate, what is it going to take?
Yep.
How many doors, how many properties that you're going to have to buy to net out $100,000? Okay, all right, good. That makes a lot of sense. So the second one is lack of focus. Okay, what do you mean by lack of focus?
Yeah, so and it kind of piggybacks off of the whole clarity side, but when you don't have focus, you know, you waste time. So with lack of focus, I mean, right now we're in the you look at, you know, social media, you look at YouTube, you look at Instagram, you know, if something is longer than 3 minutes, most people aren't going to keep watching it. You know, most people aren't going to keep listening to it. So I think that focus comes in where you're on a Friday night and you're sitting there saying, okay, do I need to analyze deals? Do I need to send out mailers? Do I need to, you know, follow up with leads? Or can I binge watch Netflix? And I think what a lot of us run into is that we, you know, we're getting ready to come up on the first part of the year, and when January 1 hits, everybody's focused, right? Everybody's like, okay, cool, we are gonna, you know, today, this year's gonna be my year, you know, 2021 is gonna be my year. But all we gotta do is wait until March. You know, a lot of us, unfortunately, in March, will have lost that focus that we started the year out. So I think you gotta have that focus to say, okay, here's how I divide my time up, here's how I work through, and here's how I, you know, in my life, right, I'm a pastor, I work a normal job, I got 3 kids, do real estate, so focus is really important for me. You know, I've got to, you know, basically say, hey, at the end of the day, I got to get these things done, and there's some other things that I can't do in order to get these things done that I need to.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of my mantras have been on my show is that with this pandemic, a lot of people have been sequestered at home and have not been able to do some of the things they normally would do. So if you're not hitting the goals that you said you're going to hit, it's not that you lack time, because you got a lot of time right now, okay?
Right.
You lack discipline. You know, does that make sense? Because everybody has time. Like you said, you could binge watch Netflix for 8 hours a day, but they ain't putting no money in your pocket, you know? But at the same time, on Netflix or on YouTube, there are videos you can watch, like yours or others that are out there, to learn how to get a skill.
Right.
And if you don't come out of this pandemic, if you don't come out of this pandemic with a new skill or a side hustle, something wrong. Okay.
Right. You got nobody to blame.
You ain't got nobody to blame, because now you got all the time in the world. So you can't go to the restaurants, and you can't go to the movies, you can't go to plays, you can't go to concerts.
Right.
Depending on the city you're in, you can't go to the bars and clubs and all that. So how are you going to get it's a mindset, and that's going to be curious to see what people are doing at that. The third thing is lack of knowledge, okay? So that hurdle is a big hurdle for new investors, lack of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that one.
Yep.
I think it's explanatory, but
go ahead. Yeah, self-explanatory, but really at the end of the day, right, we live in the information age where, you know, it's not like back in the day, you know, you had to, you know, go to the visit the local library or, you know, go in an encyclopedia. I mean, most things are just a keystroke away. But what happens a lot of times, and I think I was, you know, alluding to it a little bit earlier when I talked about wholesaling, is when the only tool you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. You know, you can only apply one thing to it, you know, and I get a lot of calls from folks who are like, hey, you know, can you show me this or explain that to me? Like I mentioned, you know, this is not osmosis where you can learn it, right? There's a price you got to pay in order to learn, right? And I think at the end of the day, one thing I've learned is something may be complicated from the first time I read it, but the more times I read it and the more time I commit and spend in it, the easier it gets me to understand. So I say all of that because this thing is really about what you know how to do. It's about your ability to network. It's about your ability to negotiate, how to solve problems, and to create deals. If this real estate investing was that simple, everybody would be doing it. And nowadays, everybody is trying to do it. A lot of people are starting it and just kind of peeling off because they run into hurdles and roadblocks, or they run into things that they don't know how to do.
And that's so true. I was one of the principals that is part of the cluster in my network of schools. He moved here from Brooklyn, New York, and he had a brownstone in Brooklyn. And he bought it for like, I want to say $400,000. He moved to Atlanta. He's been here 3 or 4 years now. He's a principal. He says that the house appraises at about $1 million. So I don't know how we got on the subject, but we were talking about real estate. And I said, so he said, well, I'm interested in doing that. Blah, blah, blah. I said, with the equity that you have in your house in Brooklyn, you would own Macon. Okay.
Right.
I said $500,000.
$30,000 with that.
Exactly. I said. He said, "Well, I'm gonna call you." I said, "Okay. Here's my number. Give a shout." Hadn't heard from him. Now, you know, there's a learning curve, and I could teach him some stuff. But at the end of the day, like you said, you're gonna have to do some of your own due diligence and get comfortable with it. But I haven't heard. And that's been about a month ago. So was he serious or not? I don't know. He said he wants to do the real estate, you know, and, you know, so everybody says they want to do it until you say, okay, let's talk about that. And then all of a sudden,
let's
go
deal.
So that's interesting, you know, because all he needs is a little knowledge. He's a smart guy, but, you know, he's got $500,000 in equity, and he could pull half of that or all of it or whatever. And
he could turn that, put that to work.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned that because it's. And that's actually one of my criteria that I use when a person reaches out to me, you know, and they say, "Hey, Marcel, you know, I saw your interview on this or your podcast on that or whatever, and I want to learn more. You know, can you mentor me?" And typically, the first thing I tell them is, "Okay, here's what I need you to do. Here's a list of books, right? And I'm going to give them probably 5 to 10 books just to read. I'm going to say you don't need to read them all right away, but in 30 days, I want you to call me back." And I want you to tell me, you know, what you learned, what you read, what you learned, what questions you have, you know. And that by itself weeds out a lot of people because they're like, man, I didn't know I needed to read. I didn't know I needed to watch stuff and listen to stuff. But in all honesty, that's what it takes. It takes you to grind. I mean, you look at Kobe Bryant or you look at Michael Jordan or any successful athlete. They weren't shining when the spotlight was on. I mean, they didn't start working when the spotlight came on. They were working at, you know, 4 or 5 a.m. when nobody was looking. And this is no different.
Exactly. And you got, like I said, you have to put in the time up front. You have to read. And for no other reason is that you want them to read so you'd have a common knowledge and a common dialogue, a common vocabulary, okay? To talk about. So when you say cap rate, you got to know what you're talking about, right? Do you know how to analyze a deal? You may have 3 or 4 metrics that you use to analyze. Everybody analyzes deals differently, but the main thing is that you got to bring in more money than the mortgage. I mean, and then this question of how much more do you want to bring in based on, as you said in the clarity, is what is your end game? It has all fit together. Okay, so knowledge is up there. Okay, action. I think we kind of talked about that, but you can go back at it. How about action? Okay. Lack of action.
Yeah, you just gotta go, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you look at your numbers, right? You trust your numbers, and if you don't, you get somebody more experienced to look at them, and then when the numbers make sense, you go for it, you know. And I think, you know, I was very fortunate on my first deal. I consider that to be kind of a home run, but if my first deal was a first base hit, it still made sense, you know. Or if it was a second base hit, it still makes sense. And I think, you know, what I found is over the course of all my deals, the first one, they're not all like that, you know. But you keep growing and you keep adding cash flow, and eventually your monthly cash flow from assets exceeds your expenses. And at that point, you got a decision to make. You know, do you fire your employer? Or, you know, or do you keep working and double dip? And, you know, but you've got options at that point. So I think at the end of the day, you just got to take action. And a lot of times we struggle because we just don't get started.
And one of the things I have found when I talk to some people who have done real estate in the past and now are soured on it, I'll ask them a question. I said, "Well, tell me what happened." He said, "Well, I had heard a property from, let's say, my mama or my grandfather, whatever. And or I bought a new house and rented out the old house. Oh, and I had so many problems with the tenant. Oh man, I just I said, so you're telling me that the strategy that has made millionaires and billionaires for folks that have two things in their portfolio, you'll find millionaires and billionaires they'll have real estate and they'll have a business. Yep. And generally they'll have both.
Right.
So you're telling me that that strategy didn't work for you? and you're going to get turned off because you got a bad tenant. So,
right.
And then they didn't scale up. You know, you just can't do it only one property. Just that
right,
one property
one time,
is a 200 or 300 unit apartment complex. You know,
right?
You know,
yep,
so
exactly.
Those are the things that people who are soured on it, they just wasn't in it, you know, to win it. They really didn't say, okay, I'm going to scale up. I'm going to own 10 properties,
right.
5 properties, 20, whatever. And that's become a big problem. But,
right.
You know, that action is so important. You've got to do something. You've got to read and then, okay, pull the trigger. And then the last hurdle you say is grit. Explain to me what that is, grit, lack of grit.
Yeah, grit is just that tenacity to say that no matter what comes, I'm going to keep going, right? So you mentioned what I call them tired landlords. And I love tired landlords because I get some of my best deals from tired landlords. That's a person who, like you mentioned, they either kept a property and they bought a new house. They may have inherited it. But at that point, they're tired of it. They're like, oh, I had a bad tenant, I had maintenance problems, whatever those are. All of those are fixable problems. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm an engineer by trade, you know, and I'm used to solving problems that are, you know, complicated or might be chemistry related or physics related. We're talking about, you know, lumber. We're talking about plumbing. We're talking about electrical, right? I mean, if you can keep water out of the house, you can keep the rodents out of the house, the house is built properly, it's very predictable, right? The challenge you run into is the people. So if you can have enough grit to say, okay, let's figure out why I got a bad tenant. And is the reason that I got a bad tenant because I didn't screen properly? Okay, cool. So I had to go through an eviction. Now I know what an eviction process looks like. But next time, I'm going to put in metrics, right? You're going to have to make 3 times the rent. You can't have evictions on your history. You need to have references. I'm going to pull your credit, right? You put the systems in place, and then next time, you're better off. So I think the whole grit piece of it is just kind of saying, you know what, there's no losses in this. It's just a lesson. And that's the way I've tried to look at it. You know, I'll give you an example. I bought a house where, you know, some of my properties I rent by the individual room. And that's a pretty lucrative type of property, but you get a different tenant base. But what I ran into is I bought a property in a different city, and I didn't realize that the rules were different or the coding laws were different in that city. So I bought the house, planning on putting 5 people in there, making a killing, only to find out I could only put 3, right?
Oh,
so, you know,
wow.
I lost sleep that night and all that kind of stuff. But then I reran my numbers, and I said, okay, I'm still cash flow positive. So, yeah, it still wasn't what I wanted it to be. But even if it was upside down, you know what? We'll figure out. We'll take our lumps. We'll sell the house, or we'll figure out what we need to do, and we'll keep on going, right? Because at the end of the day, the problem is not with real estate investing. The problem was with me. You know, I made a mistake, you know, but I learned from it. And I think that grit is just having that mindset of, okay, I'm gonna have setbacks, but I'm going to grow from them. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to learn from them, right? And if there are things I don't know how to do, I will learn them. And I think that's really what it all boils down to. And that's, for me, that's what the grit is. It's that ability to say I'm going to endure, but also I'm going to do whatever it takes to achieve these goals that I've set, not only for myself, but also to create a legacy, for those that are coming after me.
Do you use a property manager?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't want to be the guy getting the call at 3 a.m.
At their toilet over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's another issue, that you have to kind of make a decision, you know, do I want to give up some of my profit, you know, so that I can sleep at night? And have somebody that's going to take care of things, you know, because my skill set is limited. My limitation is, you know, I grew up in New York City in the Bronx, and, you know, I didn't grow up with a hammer in my hand. So I don't do that. I don't even cut my own grass, okay? You know, but that's just me. I ain't getting out there. Now, I could do some stuff, but I ain't about to go in there and do all that. So I always need somebody to handle that kind of thing. So you have a team of contractors that do all the work and stuff, even though you could probably do some of it since you're experienced.
Yeah, and for me, just to highlight on that, I think it's important to work on your business and not work in it. And that's a big difference. So if you're the guy that's out there fixing the toilet, if you're the guy that's out there, like you said, cutting the grass, if you're the one climbing up on the roof, guess what? You're not figuring out how to grow your business to get your next deal. And I think that's
right.
why you get a lot of tired landlords, is because they're thinking to themselves, they're like, well, I can fix this leak and I can fix this toilet. Well, if that toilet takes you, you know, 3 hours to fix, right, and it was, you know, what is your time worth?
You know,
what is your time rate? And if you could have hired your handyman to do that job for $50, you know, are you telling me that you're worth, you know, less than that? You know, so it's like,
right.
And I think when we kind of change our mindset, the way we think about it, it kind of puts it in perspective. So yeah, for me, I mean, I can go out there and fix all that stuff, but while I'm fixing it, I'm not looking for my next deal. So,
do you have a purchase criteria? What is your criteria? Like for me, my criteria is like $30,000, at least mm-hmm. a 15-20% cap rate, mm-hmm. and that's about it.
Okay.
You know, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, so.
With that criteria, then that mm-hmm. I can screen properties, because if it has an 8%
right.
cap rate, I'm not even looking at it. You know,
yeah,
I'm sorry,
yeah, sure.
And it has to be tenant occupied. So you know, between 30 mm-hmm. and 50. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
15, minimum 15% cap rate and tenant occupied,
mm-hmm.
because I won't get my money
gotcha.
The first day. You know, that's just me, though, okay? I don't
mm-hmm.
want to
mm-hmm.
have
yep.
something that's vacant, and then I got to go around
right.
and find a tenant. Now, down the road,
yep.
I might do that, but that's kind of me. So do you
mm-hmm.
have a purchase criteria that just says, okay, it has to hit boom, 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 and then I'll do my further
mm-hmm.
analysis? Is it? Do you have
right.
a criteria?
Yeah,
for that?
Absolutely. I think you got to have that. And so – mine is not quite as succinct, I guess, as yours, because I'm investing in different things in different ways. So if I'm doing a bird deal, right, I've got one set of criteria, right? So I want to buy that property. If I'm doing a bird, I want to buy that property for 70% of ARV, which is after repair value, because that tells me if I do that bird deal, I know I'm going to hold on to it for a while. But if I buy at 70%, then I can essentially refinance that property and then essentially have spent no money out of pocket. That's a little bit of a longer play. But if I can achieve that, then to me that's a win. If I'm buying a traditional buy and hold, I typically look at my cash on cash return. So in other words, if I spend 20% down, right, I need to get enough cash flow that I want to be somewhere, you know, 20% and above, right? If I'm just getting 10% cash on cash return, I'm like, I can get that anywhere. You know, I can just about put that in a stock market. And of course, that doesn't, you know, take into account tax savings. But if I'm just getting 10% cash on cash, then, you know, that's not the most, to me, I'm not using my money in the most effective way. So I'm really
okay.
all about the efficiency of what my cash outlay is versus what it's going to bring me back.
Got it. Got it.
So
that makes a lot.
If I'm doing cash on cash, I want, you know, 25% at a minimum.
So if you put $10,000 in a deal, then you want to get 25% of that back, basically.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And that makes sense. That makes perfect sense. Now, you mentioned, you know, you explained one part, but you said a couple of times, I want for our audience to know what that means, the bird deal. Explain what that is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, Bird, that's a great question, because we talked a little bit about flipping houses earlier, right, and why I don't flip houses. But BRRRS, which basically stands for buy, rehab, rent, refinance, and then repeat. To me, BRRRR deals are the most efficient, probably the most efficient investment vehicle there is, because what you're doing is essentially you're buying an asset, which, like I mentioned, I'm trying to buy that 70% below ARV. So if I'm buying it, I mean 70% of ARV. So if I buy the 70% ARV, and we'll just use the $100,000 example, right? So if I got a 100K property and I want to be 70% ARV, I've got to buy it and rehab it for less than $70,000. And what that's going to allow me to do is when I buy right, and I put my tenant in there, and then I go to refinance it, the bank's going to give me 75-80% of my ARV back, right? And that money is going to be tax-free money. So if I buy for 70 and I refi and I get 75 back, I actually made $5,000 to purchase a property.
Gotcha.
So I got money in my pocket, and I've got a new property, and I've got cash flow, and I didn't pay any taxes on it. Versus if I go and I flip that property, I got all them taxes, and I don't have a house anymore.
And see, one of the things that you just shared is that in real estate and what we're doing, for the most part, you make your money going in. In other words, when you buy the property,
you make your money when you buy.
You make your money when you don't want to buy at market rate, because then you can't make money that way. Okay?
Exactly.
So you've got to find deals for low marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, you have to look at a lot of deals. And my wife and I looked at maybe 15 to 20 deals before we pulled the trigger on one. Because by that time, we knew the area. We knew what was a good deal. We could eyeball stuff without having, you know, to go to get an appraisal. We could look around and say, okay, all right, this house is in pretty good shape, you know, whatever. So you got to look at a lot of deals. You can't look at one deal and just say, okay, I'm going to buy that one. You know, you look at a lot of deals, and that gives you some intel, particularly if you're buying in a particular market, to understand the market a little bit, you know. So we found out.
Yeah, you definitely want to know your numbers and your market.
Yeah, you got to know the zip codes that are, you know, up and coming, with zip codes that are, you know, more crime infested or, you know, being gentrified or whatever the case may be, to get to know the market.
Right.
And make it about 2 hours from where we live in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go down there, I'm spending the whole day. And, you know, so I was also doing that. So was your dad your mentor? Do you advise having mentors in this business? Because I do have.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, you need mentors. And mentors are going to come in many forms. Some of your mentors, believe it or not, are just going to be the books you read and the authors you follow. You don't have the benefit of asking them questions, but you do get the benefit of their knowledge and their story. So that's probably the cheapest mentor you can get is books, right? I mean, Robert Kiyosaki should be everybody's mentor, right? Brandon Turner should be everybody's mentor. But then on the what I consider like boots on the ground, you know, folks you can call up. You know, I've got probably two or three solid mentors in my life. I mean, one of them actually was one of the investors that my dad did a lot of work for. So it's funny because, you know, 20 years later, you know, I just called him up and was like, hey, I want to have lunch with you. When I got started, he's like, man, I feel like I'm talking to your dad, you know, but he's like, this is fun. You know, he's like, yeah, I really want to share that information. So he was one of them. And another guy is actually somebody who's also local to my market. And I just called him up one day and he was, you know, he's really huge on YouTube. And I was like, hey, man, can I take you out for coffee and just talk? And, you know, he's a brother like me, and he's like, yeah, I want to see you win. I want to see you succeed, however I can help you, you know. So that meant a lot. But, yeah, between those guys, they're pretty big in my life. And then, like I mentioned, just the different authors that I read and courses that I follow and stuff like that. So, yeah, mentors are critical.
Now, what's your end game? So at what point, correct me, maybe – You won't have an end point. Is there a point where you'll say, I'm done, I've got my number of properties, I'm just going to collect this cash, quit my engineering job, and chill? I mean, is there an end game like that for you? What is your end game in all of this? What do you see ultimately doing when all this is said and done?
Yeah, so for me, I think I mentioned earlier, there's two numbers that I really care about. The first one is financial independence, and the second one is financial freedom. So financial independence is pretty simple. It's just whatever I make, I want to replace my W-2 job. So when I get to the place where I can, you know, make enough through passive real estate that it exceeds what I make in my engineering job, then, you know, I will essentially fire my boss, basically. So for me, you know, I'm a pastor, and one of the things that's very, very important to me is my ministry. But I started the church, right? So the church didn't start with a 100-year-old church. You know, I started with some other families, and we've been just growing it. But I always told our leadership team, I said, hey, I never want this church to have to decide whether or not to pay me or to pay the light bill. Right. So at the point where real estate is taking care of all of my needs, I'll leave and then focus on real estate and church.
Right.
And then when I get to financial freedom, which is that time where I can just, you know, my portfolio is so big where, you know, it's almost on autopilot, where I can now focus on businesses, purchasing those. That'll be the place where I'm either, you know, starting to just teach other people, right? Because I think at the end of the day, I want to, you know, my kids, they go out with me on visits. Sometimes my daughter will help me make YouTube videos, you know, so this is, part of this is for them, you know. And like, actually, the name of my company is CKJW properties, which all stand for the initials of my kids' names. You know,
okay.
So for me, it's a part of it is for them, but then also a part of it is so that we can build wealth in the African American community. Because as you well know, the net worth of, you know, African American families is like $4,000. But then
right.
compared to, you know, our counterparts, our white counterparts, they're like $110,000. So there's
right.
just such a massive wealth gap. So I think that there will be a point where I shift my focus from acquiring assets to empowering people. And it might be through JV deals. It may be through lending, right? And that's a whole other concept, right, that we don't even have a grasp on is how do we become the bank, right? Where we, you know, we borrow at 5%, you know, but we get paid 0.5%. on the money that we have in institutions, you know, how do we cut that part out of it? And that's even, you can even do that in real estate as well, but that's another conversation for another time. But yeah, for me, end game is really that, you know, it's getting to the place of, first of all, financial independence where I can replace my wage and then get into the place of financial freedom where money is no longer a limiter in my life.
Right, right. Okay, and that's interesting. I've never heard of those distinctions because I think people equate financial independence with freedom. They generally do. In the case of what your criteria is that you're looking to have enough doors so that you replace your income, but that may not be enough, you know, because now you're looking at where, you know, I'm able to do whatever I want because I've got money built up in my, not only in my cash flow, but money sitting in other things or doing other things.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense from that standpoint and being able to do it, you know. So now quickly, you know, your ministry, you know, that's another thing that we share in common. I'm also a minister on the staff of our church here, in the AME church. So, well, the church I'm in is not an AME church, but I'm on the staff of a church here. And right now with COVID, it's definitely put a crimp, you know, in our ministry. How, how have you, or are you teaching your members some of the things you're learning in terms of financial empowerment? Are you sharing some of that stuff with your congregation?
Yeah, we do. We do usually at least once a year we do financial stewardship classes. And my wife is actually she's a Dave Ramsey financial coach as well. But we try to, you know, we do like one-on-one mentoring with couples just to kind of help them clean up credit, clean up debt. And, you know, every church is going to have people that are going to come to them for help. Right, and they're going to be. Sometimes it's just like, hey, I can't pay my bills. So what we do is we try not to just give you a meal. We try to teach you how to fish. You know, so we do a lot of work to help people to be good stewards. You know, to figure out how do they, you know, best become stewards of God's money. When it comes to real estate, you know, that's really more. That's not something that I publicize and put out to the church. It's one of those things where it's like level three, basically, right? Level one is, hey, get out of debt. Level two, you know, is learn how to be a good steward. And level three is learn how to invest. You know, how to actually build wealth. You know, it's like the Bible says, a wise man leaves an inheritance for his children. You know, so I mean, these are biblical concepts. You know, that we try to push. But yeah, definitely we do interweave that within the gospel. You know, and we're trying to build up the spirit man, but then also at the same time, you know, help people to create a legacy as well.
So, Marseille, how can people find you on social media to take advantage of some of the things that I know you're doing stuff on YouTube and Instagram? Want to share those handles so people can find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, you know, I go by the handle The Property Pastor. I haven't found another one yet, so I think it's unique. But yeah, if you just look up on Instagram, YouTube, I'm on Facebook as well. Just type in The Property Pastor. It's easy to find me. I'm located here in Hampton. And, you know, like I said, those are probably the best ways to find me. I do, you know, when folks reach out to me to do interviews and podcasts like this one, you know, I'm definitely on those as well. But typically, you know, following those, and I'm on Twitter also. But, yeah, if you follow me on any of those, you can get a hold of me pretty easy. And then my church webpage is, my church is called Branches of the Vine Community Church, so you can find me there as well.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Marseille, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to meet with me. One of the things I find interesting is that, I don't know what it is, but any millionaires seem to take to real estate investing very easy. I don't know why that is.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe process or whatever. But I have so many.
I think it's the math. Yeah.
It's the math? Okay. Maybe that's
it.
But
that's what I think it is. I think it's the numbers. I think it's the numbers and then realizing that, hey, I could be an engineer and I'm never going to get rich like this. But I mean, I can do okay, but I'm never going to, I mean, I'm working for people who are maybe not as quite as smart intellectually, but they're making way more money. So I think that light bulb goes off.
And I think what engineers have to follow a process as well, you know, here's step one, step two, step three. Like that. So I think that, of course, the math is an issue, depending on what type of engineering you're doing. But also that you have to follow a certain type of procedure to get things done. And in real estate, you have to follow steps. You got to do this. Exactly. You know, so it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Of course, say thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely. Well, it's been my honor, Charles. I've had a great time chatting with you.
Well, it's good. It's good. It's the same here. Like I said, it's just a conversation. It's these kinds of conversations that we need to have in our community more, you know, to start the dialogue, to talk about these things with like-minded people, because there's a bunch of folks out there. And one thing I know about the real estate community that, you know, they're always willing to share. You ask questions, they're going to answer it. But one thing to be clear about, there's more than one way to skin a cat. So some people are this is the only way to do it, wholesaling. Apartment building. You just have to take what you can and say, you know, and find somebody that you can talk with this stuff about. You know, like you found two or three mentors. Find some people that you can talk who inspire you, who are steps ahead of you. You don't want people who are on the same level as you are. You want to see things that inspire. Because, like, for my mentor, he owns 45 properties, single-family homes.
Mm-hmm.
He brings in $250,000 a year, okay? And he was an engineer, and he quit. He's been doing it for 17 years. So, you know, so find the help when you can and just absorb all the information. But, Marseille, thank you so much for being on Your Personal Finance. Much success to you, guy, all right?
Absolutely. I appreciate it. All right, Charles, you have a great Christmas, and God bless you, sir.
All righty, sir.
All right, take care. Yeah, bye-bye.
It's always great talking to, you know, and he sounds like a young guy. When I say young, he's probably about 15, 20 years younger than me, I'm assuming, in his 40s. Got a great future ahead of him. He's, doing great things with his real estate. It's always great to uplift those kinds of people. And, you know, I just feel always encouraged, you know, when I hear about that. And as for full disclosure, you know, I am a real estate investor, so I lean towards that, but I'm more a champion of passive income. And if you've been a listener to this podcast, you've heard me interview folks doing trucking. That's a whole big thing right now, where you can, you know, have a purchase a tractor trailer and get somebody to ride that thing and make money that way. And then there's the other thing is the vending business. There's been big interest in vending. That's Jacinta Marshall had her on a while ago. She's doing great things in vending. Okay, so that's a really big thing. But there's two businesses I'm in. I'm in real estate and in financial services. And I'll just share each one of them. And if you're interested in this podcast, interested in being a part of what me and my wife Felicia are doing, then by all means, I'll give you the mechanism to be able to contact us. With the financial services, we focus on financial planning and specifically in budgeting, setting goals, getting your credit, you know, repaired, restored, making sure you have wills and trusts, those kinds of things, making sure that you're putting yourself on the right path to financial success. And if you're interested in that, if you're interested in being a part of the financial services that we offer, then I'm going to give you my phone number, and all you have to do is just text credit, okay? Credit, CREDIT, to 404-272-4633. The other business we're in is our real estate business, where we buy single-family homes, and we're helping people learn how to do that. If you're interested in that, then all you have to do at that number, 404-272-4633, is text real estate. And then I'll know how to reach out to you. And, you know, we just have a conversation and see what you're interested in. And as we were sharing with Marseille, is that there's a lot of people that say they want to do this stuff. But when it comes down to it, they really, you know, don't have the, you know, the action plan, the clarity, the focus, the knowledge, the grit, all of that to do it. Because if it was easy, everybody would do it. But that doesn't mean you can't do it. Don't let a little work, you know, stop you from being successful financially. And I don't care what age you're in, okay, what age you're at. I'm 63 and I'm still hitting a lick, okay? So, with that being said, thank you so much for listening. Please share the podcast with other folks and your friends if you're inclined to do so. Until we talk again on Your Personal Finance with Dr. Ross, please enjoy the rest of your day.